Acts 11:19 through 11:26, continued. The 42nd talk in a series on the Book of Acts was presented by Jack Crabtree on May 14, 2000, at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2000. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction, all other rights reserved. The following recording has a brief break in the middle. This is the result of the original 60-minute tape switching to the second side.
It's our style to simply pick a book of the Bible and teach through it. So Mother's Day comes along and you're kind of at the mercy of the text as to whether there's anything in the text that has to do with mothers. There isn't. So I'm going to do my level best to make this the mother of all messages. We're in Acts chapter 11. I'm going to read the passage that we went over last week just as by way of review, and we'll probably only get another couple of verses beyond that today. I want to leave plenty of time for discussion because I think we may have some after what we look at. So I'm in verse 19 of chapter 11 of Acts. So then those who were scattered because of the persecution that occurred in connection with Stephen made their way to Phoenicia and Cyprus and Antioch, speaking the word to no one except to Jews alone. But there were some of them, men of Cyprus and Cyrene, who came to Antioch and began speaking to the Greeks also, preaching the Lord Jesus. And the hand of the Lord was with them, and a large number who believed turned to the Lord. The news about them reached the ears of the church at Jerusalem, and they sent Barnabas off to Antioch. Then when he arrived and witnessed the grace of God, he rejoiced and began to encourage them all with resolute heart to remain true to the Lord. For he was a good man and full of the Holy Spirit and of faith, and considerable numbers were brought to the Lord. And he left for Tarsus to look for Saul. And when he had found him, he brought him to Antioch, and for an entire year they met with the church and taught considerable numbers. And the disciples were first called Christians in Antioch. I think that's probably as far as we'll get. We covered the first up through verse 24 last week pretty well, but I do, by way of review, want to go back and review a couple of points that I did make and add a couple of comments to what I said last week. First of all, we looked at last week, there's several phrases in here. The hand of the Lord was upon them. Barnabas, when he saw the grace of God, when he witnessed the grace of God, and there might be a couple other phrases in here. All of them are pointing in the same direction. I just want to highlight this point we talked about a little bit last week. That the true work of God, whenever the true work of God is happening, it is due to the invisible and intangible work of God at His direction. That's true at an individual level, and that's true at a cultural or corporate level as well. We look in vain in the New Testament for the kind of thing that is commonplace in Christian culture today, and that is some kind of weekend seminar on how to build a big, large church, or a weekend seminar on how to disciple people, or how to evangelize people, how to convince people to be Christians, or how to have a better marriage, or how to parent their children better, or how to do this, or how to do that. That we teach techniques as if the genuine, authentic, sanctifying work of God is something that we can reduce to some kind of science that is in my control. And it just seems to me a reality that we have to come to terms with. We have to face into it and we have to grasp it. That the work of God is something that is invisible and intangible, can never ultimately be articulated, can never ultimately be analyzed, cannot be reduced to a science. It is the mysterious, magical, miraculous activity of God in our lives to literally recreate us, to literally transform us, and make us different. And in the process, make us different in the context of all the rest of our lives, our marriages, our parenting, our everything. We see all kinds of clues that that's how Luke is looking at this here. This is the work of God. The hand of the Lord is happening here. What deceives us is that we mistake the authentic for the counterfeit. We see sociological phenomena happening. We see people identifying themselves as Christians in droves. We see people's lives changed in some significant way, even dramatic way. And we attribute that to Christianity. We attribute to that to their conversion or something else. But we fail to recognize that all kinds of things can change people's lives. You know, you can be a cocaine pushing drug addict one day and a black Muslim the next, and your life is dramatically different. A dramatic transformation of your lifestyle, of your values and everything. But is that the hand of the Lord in somebody's life? Not necessarily. All kinds of things can give me a new meaning for my life, a new orientation, can give me a motive to clean up my act. But sanctification is a lot more than changing your lifestyle and cleaning up your act. It's a lot more than that. Sanctification goes deeper than that. It's more profound than that. It's more far-reaching than that. It's more significant than that. It's not just come to Jesus and he'll change your life. It's come to Jesus and he'll make you holy. And that's different. It's fundamentally different. So I think Luke is looking at this and observing what happened as was witnessed by Barnabas, as this was the real deal. There were people's lives being transformed here at the deepest and most profound level. The Spirit came into their lives and began to make holy people out of people who had not been holy. Now, does that mean that everyone that kind of jumped on the bandwagon at Antioch was in fact a true believer being truly sanctified? No, we can make no such claim. Because whenever the hand of the Lord is at work, you will always have other people who will see it and respond to it as if it were a sociological phenomenon and want to be a part of it, want to join in, want to share in what this remarkable thing that's happening. But they're doing it for sociological reasons. Not for existential reasons, not for spiritual reasons, not because they decided to make their life about the kingdom of God, but because they went in on this hip and groovy thing that's happening in their culture, in their society. We have to learn to make the distinction, recognize the difference, discern the difference, and we have to learn to long for the real thing, the authentic work of the sanctifying Spirit in our life. Second thing is I mentioned, I don't think I commented on this last week. I did comment in general about how when in our study of the New Testament, we have to be careful that we don't get deceived into thinking we understand a text when in fact we don't. And what gives the illusion that we understand a text when we don't is that there have been several thousand years now of a long Christian tradition that has over the course of time taught us to see particular phrases, particular clauses, particular words in a particular way, to interpret them in a particular way, regardless of whether that's what the apostles meant by those terms or not. One of those here is the term to abide in what verse? Okay, I can't see it because it's remain in my text. Verse 23, he encouraged them all with resolute heart to remain true to the Lord. It's the word that typically gets translated abide, or typically often gets translated abide in the New Testament. I remember many, many years ago being taught John, what is it, chapter 15 or 13? 15? John chapter 15. Abide in me, and I will abide in you. As the branches abide in the vine, so you must abide in me. That passage, and it was taught to me, and made perfectly good sense to me at the time. It was taught to me that was all about abiding. This passage is about abiding. And then as we go on to try to get at what it means to abide, it ends up being what I have described in the past as Star Wars theology. You know, you need to get out of the way and tap into the resources of God himself supplied to you by the Spirit of God. And how do you tap into those resources? By not relying upon your own resources. You get out of the way, set your resources aside, ignore them, and tap deeply into the resources of God himself, and your life will go better. your evangelism will go better. Your ministry will go better. You will have victory over sin. You will be a better husband or wife. You will be a better parent. You will be a better businessman. You will be better everything if you simply get out of the way and let the power of God flow through you rather than doing it on your own. Very intriguing idea. Very interesting idea. A very seductive kind of theology. One that I taught for years until I started understanding what the apostles were actually saying. And it's nothing like that. What does Luke mean by abide here? What did Barnabas mean by abide? What did Jesus mean by abide in John 15? Something a little bit more pedestrian. What he meant is what we would call persevere, keep the faith. Abide simply means remain. It simply means stay. So when he says abide in me, he's saying to his disciples, you're my disciples now. Stay that. Continue being disciples. As you go through life, don't let the circumstances of life, the pressures of life, the suffering that you're going to undergo, the persecution that you're going to undergo, don't let those other theologies that are going to come along and sound more interesting to you and make better promises, don't let them seduce you away from the simple truth that I am the Messiah sent by God to establish His kingdom, and you want to be citizens in my kingdom. That's the simple truth that you need to abide in, stay in, remain in, persevere in. Don't give up on that. Don't leave that. Don't forsake that. Just stay the course, and don't let anyone or anything derail you from that course. That's what he meant, and that's what Barnabas is saying to the Christians at Antioch: abide in the Lord. Don't forsake Him. Don't stop being His disciples. Just keep on going. I would submit that a very good litmus test of whether we really understand the gospel is whether that sounds trivial and uninteresting or sounds profound. Because I know for most of my Christian experience, if someone come along and said, you know, all he means by abide in the Lord is stay a Christian, you know, stay a believer, I know, however polite I might have been on the outside, I would have said, whoop-de-doo. I mean, what's the big deal? Of course I'll stay a Christian. Every good Baptist stays a Christian. Of course I'll do that. It wasn't until recent years that I have realized, first of all, how hard that is. How hard it is to stay a believer. How hard it is to stay a disciple. How hard it is to stay a Christian. Because there are so many things arrayed against us. So many temptations. So many lies. So many seductive stories that people tell that look so much more interesting than what seems to be the abstract truth of the kingdom of God one day. It's really hard to continue believing it and focusing my whole life on the truth of the gospel. That may look easy, but it isn't. It looks easy, again, because we mistake the counterfeit for the real, because we mistake cultural identification as Christianity with actually being a disciple. And it's not the same thing. It's easy to go to church your whole life. It's hard to remain faithfully a disciple who is living one's life in the light of who Jesus is and what He has taught us. That's not easy. And for the apostles to come along recognizing that's not easy, for Jesus to come along recognizing that's not easy and say, you got to hang in there. You have to do thick and thin. You have to remember that what I've taught you is true. Don't forget that. Don't give up on that. Is a very substantial and important warning. If we see that, then we can know that we understand the gospel. If we don't see that, we don't understand life, reality, truth, and the gospel yet. Another one in the same vein another phrase that he uses here, he talks about being brought to the Lord in 24. Considerable numbers were brought to the Lord. That's a phrase that it's not so much that we have a faulty notion of it is. We don't have any notion at all of what that is. At least I don't. Brought to the Lord is just something we talk about when somebody becomes a Christian. I suppose if we have mean anything more specific by that, we mean we evangelized them and delivered them to belief, delivered them to faith through the catalyst of my evangelistic activity. And we mean we brought them to the Lord. I don't think that's what Luke has in mind here. Luke has something very specific in mind, and I think we've lost sight of this. I've lost sight of it to the extent that I'm not sure exactly what the metaphor is. I can only get at it roughly. There's a psalm where, I don't remember what psalm it is, but it gets quoted in Ephesians in a passage that is often misunderstood, but he quotes it in Ephesians. It's David, I think, having gone to war, having gone to battle, and in the battle he's taken captives, and he's leading those captives back to Jerusalem, and he's leading those captives back to Jerusalem, to the temple, to, and I'm my memory's losing it here, but I think it's to give them to the Lord or to present them to the Lord. Something like that is what's behind this phrase, brought to the Lord, I believe. It's a metaphor of people who had been among the peoples who were enemies of God, who have been taken captive and have been delivered over to God, presented to God as an offering, as a way of honoring God, to be his citizens, to be subjects in his kingdom. They had been subjects in another kingdom, but now they're going to be subjects in his kingdom. And to bring them to the Lord is to having taken them captive and delivered them from the kingdom of darkness to the kingdom of light, where Jesus is king. Those are gifts, and that's the word that's used in Ephesians out of the psalm. They are gifts that are being offered up to God. I think that's what's behind this language here. Considerable numbers were brought to the Lord, were brought as an offering, were presented as an offering, as gifts to the Lord. It would be a bummer of a kingdom to be the king of all eternity and have no citizens in it one day. To be king for all eternity over a citizenless, subjectless kingdom. But that is not going to be the case, because there are people in this world who are going to be taken captive, delivered from the kingdom of darkness to the kingdom of light, and presented to the king as subjects of him. Something like that metaphor is behind that language. Okay, let's go on. Verses 25 and 26. Barnabas has come from Jerusalem to Antioch. He's witnessed what's already transpiring. Gentiles in Antioch, for the first time, are becoming believers and joining in the community of those people who believe in Jesus. Barnabas observes it as a genuine activity of the Spirit of God. And at one point, he decides, I've got to go get Saul. So he leaves for Antioch, goes to Tarsus, where, as you'll remember, Saul is basically hiding out. He had been run out of town in Jerusalem, escaped with his life, had a miserable early experience as an evangelist. He converted no one and only succeeded in making everybody murderously angry with him and wanting to kill him. So he flees Palestine and leaves for his hometown of Tarsus, and is holed up in Tarsus. We don't know anything about what he did during that time. We just know that he's hanging out there in Tarsus. Barnabas knows that. And Antioch is a little over halfway between Jerusalem and Tarsus, so he decides, well, let me go get him. So he goes to Tarsus to bring Saul back to Antioch, to have Saul help him in his teaching ministry at Antioch. And then when he finds him, he brings him to Antioch, and for an entire year, it says, they met with the church and taught considerable numbers, and the disciples were first called Christians in Antioch. Notice once again, I want to draw your attention to Barnabas one more time, and the same characteristic of Barnabas that we've seen before. Barnabas is already in Antioch. He's already teaching. Considerable numbers are believing because of the ministry of Barnabas. It's not obvious that he needs any help, but he goes to get Saul. Why does he go to get Saul? Well, if you'll remember, as I suggested in an earlier chapter, it's likely that Saul has communicated to Barnabas the content of the commission that Jesus, the Lord, his Messiah, has given Saul to be a a minister to the, a servant to the Gentiles. Barnabas is hip to that revelation. He knows that. He understands that. How would I have responded? How would you and I have responded? It very possibly, if we took any esteem from our ministry as teachers, from our wisdom as teachers, from the effect of our ministry, if we took any, what's the word I'm looking for, of our self-concept from that, it's very possible that we would be threatened by the possibility that Saul, by the ordination of God, would overshadow us. That his ministry would be more powerful, that it would be more extensive, that it would be more effective, that he would become more important than I was. And we would be potentially very jealous of that, very guarded of our own ministry. Barnabas didn't need any help, but he remembered the commission that Jesus had given to Saul, and he sees this as an opportunity for Saul to begin that ministry. So he goes and gets Saul and brings him back to Antioch. An incredible act of humility on his part. Not threatened by the purposes of God, not threatened by the promises of God. That deep, he has a profound commitment to wanting what God's will to be done. Such a profound commitment to God's will being done that he's willing to have God's will done even if it means he, Barnabas, is going to get overshadowed. And as history tells it, he did get overshadowed. I mean, who of us, if we didn't carefully read the New Testament, would even know about Barnabas? Would even ever hear about Barnabas? Paul, we know all about Paul. He wrote half the New Testament. A very, very significant person, a very significant role that God has given Jesus. Barnabas is not, we don't see an ounce of jealousy in Barnabas. That's just perfectly fine with him. It's really okay with him. But he's not a groupie either, as we see later in his life. There comes the point where Barnabas stands up to Paul and says, Paul, you're wrong. You're being a jerk. And they split company and go their own direction because Paul is so pig-headed about his attitude toward John Mark that he won't give John Mark a second chance. Barnabas says, John Mark deserves a second chance. Barnabas, who's generous of spirit and who's sensitive, who knows that people, when people are acceptable and that they are acceptable when they're acceptable, that they're going to make it when they're going to make it. It's the same Barnabas who took a young new convert, Saul, under his wing and brought him along and encouraged him, who is doing the same thing to John Mark. And Barnabas is right and Paul is wrong. He's not afraid. Barnabas is not a mindless person with no mind of his own and no independent thought. That's far from the truth. So much so that he stands against him. But he's humble and he recognizes that what needs to happen is God's will needs to be done. His purposes need to be carried out. And Saul is God's chosen instrument. My job is to help the chosen instrument of God get ready for his task. So that's what I'm going to do. Just an incredible, incredible act of humility, it seems to me. Okay, now I want to spend the rest of the time on this one simple little comment that Luke makes. And the disciples were first called Christians in Antioch. It's an innocent enough comment and really kind of a throwaway comment, I think, as far as Luke is concerned. I'm going to go beyond the text here a little bit and what I have to say. All Luke is trying to say, I think, is to his readers who a number of decades later have accepted as the common term to describe followers of Jesus as Christianos, or in Latin, Christianus, that's the common term that is used. And he just wants to explain, oh, by the way, here's where it started. Here's where that term first got started. I don't think that Luke means to suggest anything beyond that. Although, there's one other thing that he might have in mind, and that is, he could be drawing attention to the fact, as the sentence just before this, he says, for an entire year they met with the church and taught considerable numbers, and the disciples were first called Christians in Antioch. Those two may be working together in Luke's mind because Christianos is a Greek is the Greek counterpart. There's a word for this. It's just a transliteration of the Latin word Christianus. It's interesting that the title is fundamentally Latin in its origin. I think what that suggests is that for the first time, we see these followers of Jesus having grabbed the attention of mainstream Roman culture. Some Roman bureaucrat in Antioch has all of a sudden realized that there's this group of people, they're kind of Jews, but not really Jews because there's Gentiles among them as well, but there's a lot of them here in Antioch, and they are a group that we Roman officials need to watch and keep an eye on. Who knows what's going to happen here? They could be a social political force to reckon with. Well, how do we identify this group? Well, they're followers of Jesus. They are Christianus. I didn't know this until looking it up in studying this, but it's just the phrase, or it just comes from the name of a person and a suffix that means the follower of that person. That's all it means. In Latin, the followers of Pompey were called Pompeianus, or Pompeiani in the plural. Followers of Julius Caesar were called Caesariani in plural, or Caesarianus in the singular. It's like R-I-T-E in English. A Reaganite is a fan of Reagan, or a Buchananite is a fan of Buchanan, or Ista in Spanish, like the Sandinistas. Ianus is that sort of suffix, and that's all that it means. So this Roman bureaucrat has recognized there's a substantial enough movement here among us that we have to identify it, recognize it, watch it, and be careful. We need to be on our alert, know what's going on here among these Christiani. So what that is, it a derogatory term, as you often hear, or as I always heard? I don't think so. It looks like it's really basically a neutral term. It's just there are these people who are followers of the Christ, of this one that they call the Christ. It's not neither derogatory nor favorable. It's just a matter of fact, they're here. I think what it indicates is that what we have happening in Antioch is belief happening on such a scale that has a broad cultural impact here. Something that all of us would long to see happen in our own time, in our own place, in our own culture. Oh, that our teaching, that our belief, that our gospel that we believe could broadly impact our culture and transform it and change it and affect it for the good. We would all long to see that. It doesn't often happen in history, but here was a time and place where it happened. I should say it doesn't happen in modern history very often. And notice that it happens in connection with Saul having been brought back from Tarsus to Antioch. It's the dual ministry of Saul and Barnabas together that was the catalyst to numbers, considerable numbers of people coming to believe and having such an impact. Now, what I want to talk about a little bit, however, is the difference between these Christianoi in Antioch, these followers of Christ, and what later would be Christians, as we think of Christians. I think it's important to recognize that they're not the same thing. Christianity, in a number of years, in a number of decades, has become a different and separate religion that has departed from the apostolic teaching, I would argue. And the more I study ancient history, the more I'm convinced that that's the case. I don't mean that there was Judaism and it was its thing, and then along comes Jesus and the followers of Jesus formed a new religion as distinct from Judaism. That's not what I mean. I mean that to a certain extent that's true as well. But what I mean is the Christians of Antioch, I don't think, would recognize the Christians of 30 years later and certainly not of 100 years later. I don't think they would recognize them. Because very, very quickly, Christianity became corrupted and got transformed into a different religion. That shouldn't surprise us because we see it happening already in the pages of the New Testament itself. How many of the letters that the apostles wrote to the churches were saying, look, you guys, why aren't you believing what I told you to believe? Why don't you believe the gospel that I delivered to you? Why have you departed for another gospel? Or, you guys are thinking this. That's not what Jesus taught. That's not what we told you. So even in their lifetime, those people who have sat under the teaching of the apostles, who have ostensibly believed the gospel and become followers of Jesus, but then some false teacher blows into town, gives them another version of Christianity, and they're right there, believing that, and going off believing a whole other truth, a whole other gospel. And the apostle has to write him a letter and saying, whoa, what's going on? Why have you left the faith? And that's during their lifetime. What happened after they died? It only gets worse, with no apostle to write him a letter and tell him not to do that any longer. By the time you get to the church fathers, my experience, which is limited, I grant you, but my experience in reading the church fathers is I find one of two things. Either what they're saying is certainly true enough, but it lacks the profundity and the depth of the apostles. It's trite, it's shallow, it's repetitive, it's superficial. It has all the appearance of mouthing Christian words without any real comprehension of what they mean on the part of some of them. On the part of other church fathers, they are teaching things in their writings that are clearly and explicitly and undeniably the opposite of what the New Testament teaches, of what the apostles taught. And yet you have whole traditions that look back on the church fathers and revere them as the people who faithfully handed down the faith to us. The reality is they didn't. They distorted the faith. They didn't hand biblical Christianity down to us. In time, what we find, what goes by the name of Christianity today, is a syncretistic religion. Syncretism is where you take a little bit from here and a little bit from there and a little bit from here and a little bit from here and you roll your own. It takes phrases, concepts, names, categories from the apostolic gospel. That's true. I mean, it's recognizably Christian because it talks about Jesus, talks about salvation, talks about the gospel, talks about grace, talks about mercy, talks about forgiveness, all kinds of Christian concepts and words and categories in it. So certainly it looks Christian in that regard. But on the other hand, it's greatly influenced by great Greek metaphysical speculation. Plato and Aristotle had a huge impact on what has come down to us as Christianity. Their concerns, their interests, their perspectives, their view of reality left a big impact on Christianity, transformed it into something that the apostles would never recognize. Let me just give you one example. By the time you get to the Middle Ages, almost without exception, all of the Christian philosophers and all of the Christian theologians would describe our eternal state, the place where you and I will ultimately be when we are finally blessed with the ultimate blessing, is we are going to be, and I'll exaggerate here a little bit, but we will be disembodied minds of philosophers contemplating the eternality of the eternal eternal. And that is going to be our ultimate blessedness. Nothing like that even resembles anything that you get in the Bible. Now, granted, in their proof text would be in the Beatitudes where Jesus said, blessed are the pure in heart, for they will see God. They called it the beatific vision. And what they mean by the beatific vision is being given the eyes to see all of reality in the mind of God himself. To see the mind of God, to see God, to see the mind of God, and in God to see everything that there is to know about everything in the mind of God. Only a philosopher could get a charge out of that. Granted, Jesus said, blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God. But that's sandwiched between blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven, and blessed are you who are persecuted, for yours is the kingdom of heaven. The defining reality that all of us look forward to in the Beatitudes is clearly citizenship in the kingdom of heaven. That's we should understand seeing God interpret seeing God in the light of what it means to be in the kingdom of heaven, not the other way around. What does it mean to see God? I'm going to be where God is reigning. I'm going to have a place, a role, citizenship in that kingdom where God is going to reign as king. That's what it means to see God. And what's the significance of that? Is it that I'm going to have a mystical experience, a mystical vision of God himself? No. The New Testament is not mystical. It's that I'm going to live in a new, concrete, tangible, created material reality that is just as multifaceted, just as rich, just as textured, just as full of delights as this one, only more so. It's not going to be only rational. It's not going to be only moral. It's going to be everything that this life is and above and beyond it. That's the kingdom of heaven. And the thing that's going to make it so wonderful is that there will be no sin and there will be no death. Death will not destroy it and sin will not undermine it. That's what's going to be wonderful about the kingdom of heaven. So there's this religion that they made up, made of the pieces of the fragments of the apostolic gospel with the meaning of its terms reinterpreted, transformed, given new meaning. Greek metaphysical speculation, folk superstition creeps in. Early Christianity becomes very superstitious. Various pagan attitudes taken from the mystery religions and the ancient polytheism of the day. And all of that stuff gets all rolled together into this thing called Christianity. To top that off, it becomes highly organized and completely institutionalized. So much so that every city has a bishop, and faith gets defined as being loyal to your bishop. Your bishop tells you what to believe, and you believe it. If you don't believe it, you're not practicing faith. The bishop tells you what to believe and what liturgy to do, when, and how. You believe what you're supposed to believe, and you engage in the liturgy that he says to engage in, at the time he says to engage it, and the way he says to engage in it, and you are a believer. You are a faithful disciple, a faithful Christian. Later emerge the creeds. And the creeds define what it means to be a member in good standing of this religion called Christianity. And again, faith is defined as loyalty to that. Why did the creeds emerge? Largely a function of the power politics of the bishops in the ancient world. The Bishop of Alexandria believed one thing and had his set of followers, and the Bishop of, actually, Antioch, I believe, had another set of beliefs and another set of followers, and the question was who is going to be the more powerful bishop. So we get all the bishops together and we have this struggle and we decide we all line up with the Bishop of Alexandria. His day wins. That becomes orthodoxy. And having become orthodoxy, we define our faith by allegiance to that theology rather than the alternative theology of the other bishop. The other bishop loses out. Are we preserving the truth, or are we preserving the political power of some two-bit little unbelieving infidel in Antioch? That's Christianity. That's what Christianity became. Notice that the Christianoi here in Antioch are simply believers, people who have believed the apostolic gospel that has been taught to them by Barnabas and Paul. It's an apostolic gospel that is not primarily fueled by Greek metaphysical speculation, mystery religions, paganism of various kinds, and superstition. It's an apostolic gospel that primarily is Jewish in its core and Jewish in its background. Something that very quickly got lost sight of in organized Orthodox Christianity. Christianity becomes very Gentile very quickly, and its Jewish background and its Jewish core just gets shed. And the Jews become different. They're a different religion. Christianity cuts them off. Not so with the Christianoi in Antioch. They're still very keenly in touch with the Jewish core and the Jewish background. Notice that we have no indication anywhere in the book of Acts that the church was anything but loosely organized and not institutionalized. And the blessing of that is, if you're loosely organized, excuse me, and not institutionalized, power is not non-existent. People are still people, and people will still vie for whatever power is there. But you've certainly muted the power that anybody can have if you remain not an institution and you remain loosely organized. We seem to have a community combined of Jews who have believed and Gentiles who have believed, the only thing that makes them a community is their shared belief system, their shared hope in the gospel, their shared confidence that Jesus is the Messiah and he's going to bring about his kingdom and all that that implies. That's the thing that binds them together. They don't look for anything else to bind them together. They're not threatened by people who leave their group, leave their community. They may be concerned about them. They may plead with them. They may exhort them to come to their senses. But they're not threatened. They don't see it as disloyalty. They see it as tragic deception, taking another soul captive. A very different mentality than emerges later. Instead of bishops, what keeps them in line, what defines their belief is simply the apostolic teaching. And it's not a person who keeps them in line, it's the teaching itself. Remember, probably years ago now, when we were looking at Galatians, that striking thing at the beginning of Galatians, where Paul says, if I or an angel from heaven should preach to you, proclaim to you another gospel other than the gospel that I have already taught to you, then let him be accursed. Paul is not talking like a very good bishop, because a bishop is conceived of as having authority within his own office. To the extent that I'm a bishop, then you need to abide by what I say today and tomorrow. But what Paul is saying is, look, I'm just as much a servant of a truth that transcends me as you are. I don't have the option as bishop to come along and change my mind about anything, or to change my emphasis, or to, you know, reinterpret this gospel in any way. If I ever do that, then let me be accursed. Because the truth is, the gospel as I delivered it to you the first time. That's the truth, and that's the truth I'm a servant of, and that's a truth that stands over me, and I need to be judged by how faithful I am to that. That's my authority. No person can function as my authority, because it's a truth that stands in authority over all of us. That's his perspective, the perspective I'm sure that he taught the people here in Antioch, and the view of the New Testament. Faith is not loyalty to any person or any institution. Faith is just simply believing the gospel that the apostles proclaimed to us. That's what faith is. Faith very quickly became a badge of loyalty and an issue of loyalty, not an issue of belief. What should we be? And I'll close with this and leave time for some discussion. What do we need to be? Should we be Christians as defined by the Orthodox creeds that have come down to us over the centuries? Not really, not primarily, not that there isn't a great deal of truth in many of those creeds. That's true. But they're not all entirely true. And even those that are true are not necessarily getting at the heart and essence of what our faith is all about. Oftentimes they're saying a lot of true things about things that are really basically peripheral and not all that central to what it means to be a believer. No, we shouldn't be Christians as defined by Orthodox traditional Christianity. Rather, we should be Christians as existed in Antioch. Those are the Christians that we want to be. What I would call radical Christians. The Latin word radix means root. And what radical means is Christians who are willing to go back to the very source, go back to the very root of what the gospel is all about. Their belief, in their spirit, in their agenda. We need to be radical in that sense and be radical Christians. The thing we have to recognize, though, is that anytime you opt to be a radical Christian, you will always, and I can underline always, you will always be suspected of being a cult. I have often been accused of being a cult or being a part of a cult. And why? It's understandable. Because if you are committed to being a radical Christian, then there's going to be something you're going to see, some insight you're going to have from the Bible, some perspective that you're going to take that isn't going to be recognizably Christian in the orthodox and traditional sense. It's inevitable that that's going to be the case. Now, what makes life more complicated is many groups that really truly are cult-like in a negative sense, in a sense that should make us think twice, also claim to be radically Christian in the sense in which I've defined it. I mean, how many cults do you know that their whole appeal to you is, look, we don't believe what Christians have always believed. We're just going to go back and read the Bible. And we're going to take the Bible at face value and interpret the Bible for what it really is and go back to the original faith as delivered by Jesus. The Mormons make that claim. The Jehovah's Witnesses make that claim. All kinds of other funky little groups make that claim. So how is my claim any different? Well, before I answer that, notice also that the false teachers that John the Apostle is combating when he writes the letter to 1 John appear also to be making that claim. These false teachers are saying, you know, the apostles, they distorted Jesus' message. They're not giving you the straight story. We're here to set things straight. We're going to tell you what Jesus really taught. And that's why John goes overtime, works overtime in 1 John to say, look, I was there. I saw him. I heard him. I touched him with my hands. Everything that he taught concerning the word of life, I was right there, hanging on every word, hearing every word, listening to every word. And I'm here to tell you what we apostles have delivered to you is exactly what Jesus taught us. And I was an eyewitness. I can vouch for the fact that that's true. These latecomers who are making some weird claim to have had some mystical encounter with Jesus and Jesus taught them differently, they are liars, they are deceivers, and don't listen to them. So it's always going to be a ploy that any group is going to use. It's a very effective and ingenious ploy to come along and say, we're going to do away with thousands of years of Christian tradition and we're going to go right back to the very teaching of Jesus himself and rediscover that. And we're going to become followers of that. It's easy to claim that. It's another thing to deliver. And so we have to make a distinction between claiming such a connection with the source and actually going back to the source. But just because many bizarre, outlandish groups are going to make that claim doesn't mean that we shouldn't make that the ideal. On the contrary, that should be our ideal. To be radical Christians going back to the source is the only way to be truly Christian, to truly be a disciple of Jesus. What's to protect us from becoming just some sort of two-bit heretic like all the rest of the outlandish groups? Three things seem to me to characterize other groups who claim to be radically Christian. The most important is almost always they miss important pillars of biblical teaching, of apostolic teaching. And two of them are noteworthy. There's sometimes more, but two of them are noteworthy. Their doctrine, if you look at it discerningly, with care, thoroughly, look at it thoroughly, they don't reflect any knowledge of the real God who really is there. The God of the Jehovah's Witnesses is not really a God of grace and mercy, if you look at their theology carefully. It's not the God of the New Testament. It's not the God who sent Jesus to be the propitiation for our sins so that he could take people who are fundamentally unworthy and grant them a place in the kingdom of God anyway. The God of the apostles is not the God that the Jehovah's Witnesses seem to recognize. I won't say all Jehovah's Witnesses, maybe some of them do, but their official, you know, teaching doesn't represent the God of the apostles. And I think you'd find that in any real bizarre cult, is that they're really worshiping a different God, another God, not the God of the apostles. And secondly, they don't understand the problem of human existence the way the apostles do. They don't understand human sin. They don't understand human depravity. They don't teach that the problem of my life is me and my own sinfulness. Not really. Their salvation is a different sort of salvation. It's a whole different gig. It's not what the apostles were talking about. But to see that, it takes more than just looking at the superficial differences between what they're saying and what traditional Orthodox Christians are saying. It takes understanding profoundly and deeply where their theology is coming from and discerning that at its root, at its base, it's not where the apostles are coming from. And so therefore, it's not really radically Christian. It's not really returning to the apostolic teaching. A second thing that often characterizes these groups is their eccentricity. They are really eccentric. A Jehovah's Witness came to the door the other day, that 80-some-year-old lady, really, you know, delightful lady. But I always shock Jehovah's Witnesses because I don't attack them in the normal places, in the places that they're used to being slammed. And the big deal for them, of course, is that, well, she said, I suppose you've heard all these stories of catastrophes where the whole earth is going to be destroyed and everything. But that's not going to happen because the Bible teaches that God is going to come and build his kingdom on this earth. Well, I happen to be able to agree with her on that because I think that's true, that the kingdom of God is going to be built on a new earth, in the new heavens and the new earth. I mean, I don't see how you can read the Bible and not recognize that that's what the claim is. It's not this traditional notion of going to heaven, whatever that is, but the kingdom of heaven is going to be established on a recreated earth in the new heavens and new earth. So I could agree with her to that, to her surprise and delight and shock and so on. But I said, but I'm not so sure that this earth isn't going to be destroyed. I mean, Peter talks about the earth and the heavens being destroyed by fire. And we went back and forth a number of times. She was so eccentric. Because I had agreed with her on 99% of her doctrine, but it was a travesty that I couldn't agree with her on that little 1%. Nope, it's going to be this earth. This earth is going to stay, and this earth is the earth upon which she's going to build her kingdom. Contrary to what seems to be the clear teaching of the Bible, but this is what we believe. Earlier, I had another conversation with another Jehovah's Witnesses. Somehow they like me, but with another Jehovah's Witness. And this lady, I believe, was truly a believer. Most of the time I spent teaching Romans to her, and she sat back going, yeah, that's one, exactly, yeah. And I mean, I think she was genuine. I think it was really striking some chord in her that I think she really believed. I think she was a true believer. But we parted company on pledging allegiance to the flag. And she thought I was just the most horrible. I was just so sorrowful that somebody who could understand Romans so much was not going to be one of the 144,000 or whatever, was not going to make it because the idolatry of pledging allegiance to the flag. And I assured her I didn't mean it, but it was no big deal to her. I mean, it was a huge big deal to her. It's typically what makes a cult is they become so off-centered, they become preoccupied, obsessed with utterly trivial, peripheral issues at the same time that they've lost the center completely and even rejected the center. The grace of the God who is there, who's a merciful God, who is willing to grant to people who are unworthy of anything citizenship in his kingdom one day. I mean, that's the core. That's the center. That's why the good news is good news. The good news is not Jesus came into the world so you don't have to pledge allegiance to the flag any longer. And yet, you sure couldn't have proved that by this lady. And then thirdly, what makes cults oftentimes a cult is the authoritarian structure of the thing. That there's some leader that's expecting you to be loyal to him and to believe what he teaches and to follow him to the end at all costs, even to drinking Kool-Aid if necessary. Having said that, I think we need to recognize that that's not just among cults, though. And that's the thing that's so bizarre. I can remember when I was in college, there was a teacher who was really pretty widely influential, a guy named Bob Thiem. Some of you may have, that may ring a bell with some of you. He was, no one in a million years would have ever accused him of being a cult leader. He was trained at Dallas Seminary. He taught mainline straight Dallas Seminary theology. I mean, it was as orthodox as the driven snow in terms of his basic theology. But the guy at the end of his life was downright bizarre. He would come in full-dress military uniform to the Star-Spangled Banner plane with American flags on either side of him, march into his podium and his, overhead projector, and in full-dress military uniform would then proceed to give you every person, number, tense, verse, tense and mood of every Greek verb in the passage, completely trying to snow people with fragments of Greek knowledge, and then and teach his orthodox Dallas Seminary theology and be a real jerk about it. I heard a tape once where you have to reconstruct what's going on because you don't have a visual, just an audio, but he's teaching, and all at once he stops and he says, "You missed that, didn't you? You had to fluff up your hair. You had to do something with your hair. And while you were doing something with your hair, you missed that, didn't you? Well, that's flaky. But then, of course, you're a female, and flaky goes with female." And then proceeded to go back to his Greek. I mean, what an egomaniac that this is all about. This is all about you paying attention to me. This is all about your hanging on my every word. This is all about you ultimately needing me and recognizing that I'm the only one who has truth and I'm the only one that can offer you anything. But he was as orthodox as could be. It's just a human phenomenon that there will always be among us people whose agenda is to have power over you, whose agenda is to make you dependent upon them and to expect you to grant loyalty and authority to them. But that's just as true in Orthodox circles as it is in these heretical cult-like circles. That's just human. I guess the bottom line is, I recognize that in a group like ours that is committed to being radically Christian and is committed to going back to what the apostles and Jesus actually taught, there is going to be a fear of the stigma of heretic and the fear of the stigma of cult. I'm not sure why it has the power over us that it does, but it does. And I know that it does. I recognize that it does. And I feel it, or at least I used to feel it more strongly than I do now, but I have felt it and I have recognized the power of that stigma. But I'm just wanting to suggest that we shouldn't fear it. There's all kinds of things that go into making a cult, and a heretic, and believing the Bible is not one of them. Believing what the Bible actually teaches does not make somebody a heretic, even if it makes us non-traditional in our beliefs. At the same time, we must not succumb to the temptation to take pride in our outlandish, outrageous unorthodoxy for its own sake. Our goal is not to be different. Our goal is not to be apart. Our goal is not to be unorthodox. Our goal is to understand what Jesus taught. Our goal is to understand what the apostles teach. And there's going to be a serious temptation. Some of you will feel it more than others, but there's going to be a serious temptation to want to go all the way and be unorthodox just for the sake of being unorthodox. But let's remember how much in common a radical Christian will always share with the more traditional Orthodox Christian. There's a huge body of beliefs that we share in common, and that should be true, and that always will be true. I am sometimes accused by my friends of wanting to be different just for the sake of being different. And I don't know how to answer the charge, except to say as sincerely as I can from the bottom of my heart, I would love to not be different. I would love with all my soul not to be different. I wish every Christian on the planet believed the Bible, really believed the Bible, and believed the Bible so firmly and so profoundly and with such insight and with such depth that I was invisible that I didn't at all appear different and outlandish. That's what I wish, because it's the truth. And I wish we as Christians all believe the truth. I would love the day when I no longer stand out as having odd beliefs. But it seems to me, in the climate that we live in, there's no way that we can't end up looking different. Because we look at the Bible differently, or at least I believe we should look at the Bible differently. We should see it not as just this symbol that we wave and flag that we wave, symbolizing our alleged allegiance to the Bible, but we should take that allegiance to the Bible so seriously that we read it and we study it and we think about it and we seek to have it teach us and transform our beliefs and channel our beliefs into the truth. Questions, comments? Didn't leave as much time as I wanted. Sorry.
I'm prepared for somebody else to, if they want to, but I did have a question.
Okay.
Well, you're going along. Actually, I don't know how much time you have to address this, but as you're talking about that sort of taking the Bible seriously, you know, doing things the way the, you know, understanding life the way the Bible is really teaching and so on, I have encountered people along the way who have made similar sorts of pleas, you know, we need to go back to the Bible, but the nature of what they seem to be calling us to is more like, in the Bible, you know, they met in homes instead of at a senior center, and so we're being unbiblical because we're meeting in a large group in a senior center instead of in a home, or like that, as if the goal is to go back and sort of whatever it is they did, do that. And if we're doing it just exactly the way they did it, we're being biblical, and if we don't, we're not. Could you just briefly describe the difference between that and what you're talking
about? Yeah, part I think of the task of understanding the Bible is to understand what is actually central to its message and what is peripheral, tangential, on the circumference of what the Bible is saying. And we need to recognize that the Bible is written at a particular time in history, in a particular language, to a particular culture, to a particular time in history, and that much of what the Bible is saying pertains to that culture, that time, their history, and so on. We need to learn to discern the difference between what about what's being said only pertains to them because it's written to them, and what about, and what is it in what's being said that is, has universal importance to every human being as a human being? And that's part of the task of biblical interpretation, is to be able to make that discernment accurately and wisely. And so, yes, certainly we have to do that. What I mean by believing the Bible and going back to the Bible is not going back and recreating biblical culture, but rather going back to the Bible and believing the abiding, universally relevant worldview that the Bible is intended to reveal to us, and live my life in the 20th century in the light of that abidingly true worldview. And there's probably a lot of details that we could get into that biblical interpretation is an art that we have to train ourselves in. It is not easy. I don't want to pretend for a second that all you have to do is pick up your Bible and start reading it and all is going to go well. You're going to make all kinds of stupid decisions. I have. I've believed all kinds of stupid things on the basis of the Bible in the past because I just wasn't untrained. I wasn't thinking right. But in time, you yourself can catch your own stupid conclusions because you're an intelligent human being. You're just inexperienced. And over time, dialoguing with other people, thinking more deeply about it, learning more, getting a bigger grasp of a bigger chunk of the Bible, you'll begin to see, get things in perspective, and have some depth perception about what's in the periphery, what's important, what's not important in the Bible. And that takes time. In the very, very back.
When you talk about going back to the Bible, I always get in all these interesting discussions with some friends of mine about how can you, when they confront me with this, and like, how can you go back to the Bible when you have so many different versions, like New King James, NIV, NAS, etc. And which Bible, I guess, do you go back to? And my, you know, I've always been tempted to say that the fundamental message behind them is, in each one, is the same. But what is, I guess, the difference, or is the fundamental message behind each of them the same? Because I haven't read all of them, to be perfectly honest. I haven't read all of any one of them.
Okay.
So going back to the Bible, you know, how do you address that, I guess?
Well, I want to answer that in two ways. On the one hand, the Bible we want to go back to are the original autographed copies of the Greek manuscripts that came from the secretaries who transcribed what Paul was saying, etc. We want to go back to the original Greek text.
All right.
That's the only text that we should trust,
okay,
ultimately. So on the one hand, only the Greek text. On the other hand, any of them will do. Because any of those Bibles that you mentioned is, for the most part, a reasonable translation of the New Testament text. The message of the Bible is not in the details. It's in the message that is in and around it, is in and around and comes through the words of the text. It's not in the actual text itself. The English translation of the New Testament text is no less inspired than is the Greek text itself. There's nothing magical about the letters being used.
Right.
It's what is the understanding of the apostles that they were trying to convey to me through those words that they used. That's what is inspired, and that's what we need to make ourselves and our own thinking subservient to.
Mm-hmm.
You don't need to know Greek to in large measure get that, to understand that. See, that's the huge mistake that someone like Bob Thiem made. And you have a lot of, every generation has a Bible teacher who will parse every verb and decline every noun in the Greek New Testament and snow you with their knowledge of the fragments of Greek. And they don't know the least little thing about language and how language works and how an argument gets put together and how you decipher what a person is saying in the words that they use. In other words, they don't know how to do exegesis. All they know how to do is decline nouns and parse verbs. Well, that may sound impressive to somebody who has not studied Greek and doesn't know Greek, but the fact of the matter is, you are all intelligent human beings, and if you simply give yourself the liberty to think with an open mind and use your common sense and use your rationality to try to set yourself to the task, what is it that Paul is trying to say here in this paragraph? You're not going to get it the first time through or the second time through or even the 20th time through because it's hard stuff. But over the course of time, thinking about it and reflecting on it, you have all that you need to come to some kind of understanding of what he's trying to say to you without knowing an ounce of Greek. And any one of those translations will do to that task that we should set before us, because they're all reasonably accurate translations.
Okay.
Sometimes, you know, they'll translate one sentence or so that's kind of misleading or not the way I would translate it, understands what Paul is saying differently than I would. But one sentence is not going to corrupt your understanding of an entire three paragraphs. You know, what you need to understand it is in the three paragraph chunks, not in the word by word detail of it. Understand the three paragraph chunks and you'll be doing just fine. And you can do that in English or any other language or Greek. Okay, I need to let you go. Thanks.